I shortened this sermon up a little bit. I only have 13 pages with this one. So maybe you get to eat supper tonight. This lesson is about stewardship. And in order to explain what stewardship means, it's real simple in a way. It's the head of a particular branch of a great house, like the chief cook or the head servant. And often the master would make one of the slaves a steward over all of the other slaves, as was the case with Joseph. And we're going to talk about him because I can't think of another example that's better than Joseph when it comes to stewardship. In the New Testament, the original word is oikonomos, and that's two Greek words. Oiko means house, and nemo means to arrange or to distribute or to manage. And so what you're doing is you're managing the house, which you ladies out there know exactly what I'm talking about. If you have your Bibles, you can turn to Genesis chapter 39. We'll talk a little bit about Joseph and his opportunities that he had to steward. And we're going to start in verse 1. It says, "Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. And the Lord was with Joseph." I want you to notice that phrase right off the bat. "So he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And now his master saw that the Lord was with him, and how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. And so Joseph found favor in his sight and became his personal servant, and he made him overseer over his house. And all that he owned, he put in his charge. And it came about that from the time he made him overseer in his house and over all that he owned, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house on account of Joseph. Thus the Lord's blessing was upon all that he owned in the house and in the field. So he left everything he owned in Joseph's charge. And with him, there he did not concern himself with anything except the food which he ate." Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance, and we know that got him in trouble with Potiphar's wife. Remember that Joseph was thrown in jail because of Potiphar's wife and her evil desires. But God was still with him. And if you skip down to verse 19, God blesses him again, even when he's in jail. "Now when this master heard the words of his wife, which she spoke to him, saying, 'This is what your slave did to me,' his anger burned." He was talking about Potiphar here. Excuse me. "So Joseph's master took him and put him into the jail, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. And he was there in jail." Verse 21, "But the Lord was with Joseph and extended kindness to him and gave him favor in the sight of the chief jailer. The chief jailer committed to Joseph's charge all the prisoners who were in the jail, so that whatever was done there, he was responsible for it. And the chief jailer did not supervise anything under Joseph's charge, because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made him to prosper." Of course, we know what happened then. He was, he came in contact with the two servants of Pharaoh who had been thrown in jail with him. And he interpreted their dreams to the point to where they came true. And Joseph said, "Remember me when you go back into the service of Pharaoh." Well, they forgot him. And he stayed there for 2 years before he was the servant thought about him and told Pharaoh, "Hey, this guy can interpret your dream." And so they came and got him out of prison to interpret the dream. And Pharaoh was so impressed with his interpretation of the dream. If you look at chapter 40 and verse 1, it says, "So when all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried out to Pharaoh for bread. And Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, 'Go to Joseph. Whatever he says to you, you shall do.' And when the famine was spread over the face of the earth, then Joseph opened up all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians. And the famine was severe in the land of Egypt. And the people of all the earth came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph because the famine was severe in the earth." He did such a good job of interpretation. Pharaoh gave him charge of actually the entire country to put up the grain so that they would have the seven, when they had the 7 years of famine, they would have enough grain to eat. And this is really the true definition of stewardship, is to manage something to the point to where it will take care of you and the people around you. There's one other place that we can look for definitions of stewardship, and that's in the animal kingdom and also in the insect world. I want you to turn to Proverbs chapter 6 and verse 6. What's really interesting here is one of the smallest of all God's creatures is mentioned here twice, once in Proverbs 6:6, and then in verses 24 and 25 in chapter 30. And it says in 6:6, "Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider its ways and be wise." And then in verse 24 and 25 of chapter 30, it says, "Four things on earth are small, yet they are extremely wise. Ants are creatures of little strength, yet they store up their food in the summer." And I'd like to read to you a little bit about the ant and how smart they are. They're so small, but yet they do so much in their particular world. In communication, ants communicate with each other by using pheromones and sounds and also in touch. And since most ants live on the ground, they use the soil surface to leave pheromone trails that may be followed by other ants. And I've often wondered about this, how in the world they can have a trail of ants, and you think, oh, well, they're just following one another. Well, somebody had to find that food. And so one of the rogue ants will go out and find the food, and then he'll mark the trail all the way back to the hive. And in species that forage in groups, a forager that finds food marks a trail on the way back to the colony. And this trail is followed by other ants. And these ants then reinforce the trail when they head back with the food to the colony. And when the food source is exhausted, no new trails are marked by returning ants. And the scent slowly dissipates and disappears. This behavior helps ants deal with the changes in their environment. For instance, when an established path to the food source is blocked by an obstacle, like you put your foot down, or a car parks in the way, or you sit something on the ground that blocks their path, the foragers leave the path to explore new routes. And if an ant is successful, it leaves a new trail marking the shortest route to the return. And successful traits are followed by other ants, reinforcing better routes and gradually identifying the best path. So you may have four or five different paths around this obstacle, and they choose the shortest one to come back to the colony. Of course, they use pheromones for other things too. If you crush an ant, he emits an alarm pheromone that sends nearby ants into an attack frenzy. And I know y'all have seen this. When you kick a fire ant hill, what happens? They go nuts. And this is what happens. And it attracts more ants from far away. And several ant species use these propaganda pheromones. Foraging ant travels distances up to 700 feet. That's just amazing to me. From their nest, and the scent trails allow them to find their way back even in the dark. In hot and arid regions, the day foraging ants face death from desiccation, so the ability to find the shortest route back to the nest reduces that risk. And ants that live in the desert, like the Sahara, and those ants navigate by keeping track of direction as well as distance traveled. Now, listen to this. Distances traveled are measured using an internal pedometer that keeps count of the steps taken, so they know what the distance is internally. Now, how can a little bitty ant know that? It's because God designed them that way. And also by evaluating the movement of objects in their visual field. And directions are measured using the position of the sun. Some ant species are able to use the Earth's magnetic field for navigation. Isn't that amazing? Leafcutter ants feed exclusively on fungus that grows only within their colony. They continue collecting leaves, which are taken to the colony, and they're cut into tiny pieces and placed in the fungal gardens. They actually have gardens in the colony. The larger ants cut the stalks, the smaller workers chew the leaves up, and the smallest tend to the fungus. And the leafcutter ants are sensitive enough to recognize the reaction of the fungus to different plant material, apparently detecting chemical signals from the fungus. And if a particular type of leaf is found to be toxic to the fungus, the colony will no longer collect that leaf. That's amazing. The ants feed on structures produced by the fungus, and the symbiotic bacteria on the external surface of the ant produces antibiotics that kill bacteria introduced into the nest that would harm the fungi. So they're actually protecting their food source with antibiotics that come from them. Isn't that neat? Now, there are several different animals that are mentioned in Proverbs chapter 30. If you look at verse 26, it says, what about the badger? Well, the badgers are creatures of little power, yet they make their home in the crags. And what he's talking about are the cracks in the rocks. Of course, it's rocky in that part of the world over there. And they can live almost anywhere, and they can adapt to almost any environment. The next is in verse 27. It says, what about the locusts? Locusts have no king, yet they advance together in ranks. How do they do that? They communicate with each other, even as small as they are. Then in verse 28, it says, what about the lizard? The lizard you may grasp with their hands. In other words, it's big enough you can pick up. Actually, the biggest lizard is the monitor, what do they call it, monster. I can't remember. He's like 20 feet long, weighs 3 tons. Yeah. Yet he is in king's palaces. They're so small they can get into little bitty cracks. I read an article several years ago, it's probably been 30 years, that talked about lizards being the best house pet you can have, because you very rarely see them. They're clean. And they eat every bug and spider in the house. That's what they live on. Now, I know you women probably don't want lizards running around in your house, but they can be pets. And then in Luke 9 and verse 58, he talks about the foxes and the birds. The foxes have dens, the birds have nests. It has amazed me over the years what the birds have done to my building. At Southern Fence, they literally ruined it by building nests. I had put chicken wire in the ceiling to protect the insulation, but it didn't do any good. You ever thought about beavers? We had nightmares trying to get rid of the beavers in Mississippi when we were farming. They would choke up every drainage ditch we had. We'd blow them out with dynamite, dig them out with backhoes, and guess what? The next morning, it was just like it had been before we ever blew it up or dug it out. amazing animals. And I've said for years that the Corps engineers need to hire some of those guys. I have about 30 hummingbirds at my house just about every year, and this year is no different. They're the only bird that can fly backwards. They are amazing creatures. They only weigh an ounce. They can fly 35 miles an hour, but yet they can migrate in some instances over 3,000 miles. And it's hard to believe that they can eat enough sugar water and enough nectar to keep them viable for flying 3,000 miles at 35 miles an hour. But they do it. Squirrels. How many of you have had trouble keeping squirrels out of bird feeders? I've seen them hang by their tails and just demolish my bird feeders in the yard. Bears. They eat really good during the summer and the fall. Why? Because they're going to sleep all winter. Don't you think that's odd that a bear cannot lose enough weight that he's not going to die when he hibernates? There's so many things, so many traits and attributes that we can learn from the animal kingdom and from insects that we need to emulate. Now let's look at the stewardship of man. If you turn to Luke chapter 16, verses 1 through 2, we have the story of the unrighteous steward. Jesus told his disciples there was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and asked him, "What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management because you cannot be manager any longer." And the manager said to himself, "What shall I do now? My master has taken away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig and I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do. And when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their house." So he called in each one of his master's debtors, and he asked the first, "How much do you owe my master?" 900 gallons of olive oil," he replied. And the manager told him, "Take your bill and sit down quickly and make it 450. And then he asked the second, "How much do you owe?" And he said, 1,000 bushels of wheat." He replied, "Take your bill and make it 800. And the master commended, listen what he called him, the dishonest manager, because he had acted shrewdly. He commended him because that's what he should have been doing all along, but he wasn't. He was wasting his master's property. "For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than the people of light." And if you look at verse 10, it says, "Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. And whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much." So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with the true riches? Talking about spiritual riches. "And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own?" Now, there's seven things that we can take away from this. The first one is that wealth deceives the owner into believing that it's his, even if he's just the manager of it. Number two, it strongly tempts him to trust in riches. And then number three, in making a man depend on them for happiness, the riches rob him of salvation and the glory of God. And number four, it estranges him from his earthly friends. And then number five says it surrounds him with false friends who will wind up betraying him in the end. And number six, wealth promises much and delivers nothing. And number seven, it's a constant hazard to our spirituality. And we don't need any more hazards than we already have in our life with our spirituality. Now let's look at the loyal steward. And that's in Luke chapter 12. It starts in verse 37. "It will be good for those servants whose master finds them watching when he comes. Truly I tell you, he will dress himself to serve, will have them recline at the table, and will come and wait on them. It will be good for those servants whose master finds them ready, even if he comes in the middle of the night or toward darkness or daybreak. But understand this, if the owner of the house had known at what hour the thief was coming, he would not have let his house be broken into. You also must be ready, because the Son of Man will come at an hour when you do not expect him. And Peter asked, Lord, are you telling this parable to us or to everyone? And the Lord answered, who then is faithful and a wise manager, whom the master puts in charge of his servants to give them their food allowance at the proper time? It will be good for that servant whom the master finds doing so when he returns. Truly I tell you, he will put him in charge of all his possessions. Remember Joseph? But suppose the servant says to himself, my master is taking a long time in coming, and he then begins to beat at the other servants, and both men and women, and to eat and drink and get drunk. And the master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him, and at that hour he's not aware of. And he will cut him into pieces and assign him a place with the unbelievers. The servant who knows the master's will and does not get ready or does not do what the master wants will be beaten with many blows. But the one who does not know and does things deserving punishment will be beaten with few blows. And from everyone who has been given much, much will be demanded. And from the one who has been entrusted with much, much more will be asked. And the takeaway from this parable, first of all, is we must be ready and faithful all the time, even when we're asleep. In other words, we need to make sure that when we lay down at night, that we have made our lives right with the Almighty before we go to bed, so that when He comes, or if He comes at night, we're going to be found faithful. Second, we don't need to think that because the Master delays in coming that we can do whatever we want. Remember, He said, when you think he's not coming, that's when he's going to come. Third, we need to know that the master expects us to use what we have been entrusted to use on this earth to further his kingdom. And that means everything we own. And then fourth, it appears that there will be degrees of punishment for those who do not obey. And that's a different subject for a different time. Bowles summarized this by saying the punishment will be proportioned to the powers, gifts, opportunities, and knowledge of the offenders, which is true. Now, I have a series of questions that I'm going to ask, and then I'm going to give you a scripture and then a comment, if that's okay. How are we to be stewards of the mysteries of God? Well, 1 Corinthians 4, verses 1 and 2 says, this then is how you ought to regard us, as servants of Christ and as those entrusted with the mysteries of God that has been revealed. And it is required that those who have given a trust must prove faithful. And then if you look at 1 Peter 4 and verse 10, it says, each of you should use whatever gift you have received to serve others as faithful stewards of God's grace in its various forms. Of course, the next verse in verse 11 says, if anyone speaks, let him speak as it were the oracles of God. So that's another story too, but it fits in with this verse. So whatever gift you have, you must serve others with it. That's what this verse tells us, as stewards of God's grace. Next question, is the elder to be God's steward? Absolutely. In the list of qualifications in Titus 1 and verse 7, it says an overseer is God's steward. He must be blameless, not overbearing, not quick-tempered, not given to drunkenness, not violent, not pursuing dishonest gain. Well, here Paul's talking about the elder being God's steward of the congregation that he is over, but the steward here is used in a spiritual sense of watching over the souls of the ones under him and the other elders. In Acts chapter 20 and verse 28, it says, "Take heed to yourselves and to all the flock to which the Holy Spirit has appointed you overseers, to feed the church of God, which he purchased with his own blood." The job of the elders is to feed the flock, to give them the spiritual nourishment. We're not talking about hamburgers. We're talking about the Bible. We're talking about spiritual food. And that's what we try to do, Glenn and Jeff and I. The next question: does contentment have anything to do with stewardship? Well, if you look at 1 Timothy 6, 6 through 10, it says, "But godliness," listen to this, this is a really good verse, "but godliness with contentment is great gain." In other words, you can amplify the godliness that you already have by adding contentment. "For we brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that. Those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap, and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil, which while some coveted after, have erred from the truth and pierced themselves through many sorrows." And then if you look at Philippians chapter 4 and verse 11, it says, "I'm not saying this because I am in need, for I have learned to be content in whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want." Well, how can we be good stewards if we're not content? The opposite of contentment is want, which turns into greed, which is idolatry. And that's what Colossians 3 verse 5 says. Happiness does not start with material things. Only the love of God can give us the peace and the happiness that we desire and want. John 14:27 says, "Peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you. Not as the world gives to you, I give it to you. Do not let your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid." And the next question I have is there an admonition for the rich then? Yes, there is. Later in that chapter in verse 17, it's 1 Timothy 6. It says, "Command," notice that first word, "command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. In this way, they will lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, so that they may take hold of the life that is truly life." And of course, that's talking about eternal life. And here on this earth, true life is in Christ. And that phrase is used by Paul in his letters 169 times. So it must be important. And of course, the only way to get into Christ is through baptism, and you can find that in Galatians 3:27 and Romans 6:3-5. The next question: where's the proper place to spend riches, and how is this done? Well, you can find that in Matthew chapter 6 and verse 19 through 21. It says, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moths and vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moths and vermin do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there is your heart also." So if we look at where our treasure is right now, we can tell where our heart is. That's what he's telling us. And we only need to place it in heaven. The next question: Should we be stewards toward our families? I would say so. 1 Timothy 5 and verse 8 says, anyone who does not provide for their relatives, and especially for their own household, is denied the faith and is worse than an infidel or an unbeliever. And of course, we know that no unbeliever is going to go to heaven or have the hope of it. Next question. Who owns this stuff anyway? First Chronicles 29:10-16 is one of the greatest verses in the Bible, and you've probably never heard of it. And it was spoken by David. And we're going to start in verse 10 and read through 16. And I want you to listen to what David says. David praised the Lord in the presence of the whole assembly, saying, praise be to you, Lord, the God of our father Israel, from everlasting to everlasting. Yours, Lord, is the greatness and the power and the glory and the majesty and the splendor. For everything in heaven and earth is yours. Yours, Lord, is the kingdom. You are exalted as head over all. Wealth and honor come from you. You are the ruler of all things. In your hands are strength and power to exalt and give strength to all. Now, our God, we give you thanks and praise your glorious name. But who am I? And who are my people that we should be able to give as generously as this? Everything comes from you, and we have given you only what comes from your hand. We are foreigners and strangers in your sight. As were all of our ancestors. Our days on earth are like a shadow without hope. Lord, our God, all this abundance that we have provided for building you a temple for your holy name comes from your hand, and all of it belongs to you. Even the clothes on your back this morning don't belong to you. They belong to God. The language here is very, very clear. And it ought to build us up and to make us think more about where this stuff comes from. Okay, next question. What should we do with some of the wealth and how much? Well, Proverbs 3, 5 through 10 tells us this. It says, trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. That's really good advice. In all your ways, submit to him, and he will make your path straight. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and shun evil. This will bring health to your body and nourishment to your bones. Honor the Lord with your wealth, with the first fruits of your crops, and then your barns will be filled to overflowing, and your vats will brim over with new wine. Now, this is not the prosperity gospel. He's just telling us that we're going to have what we need if we give him what we know he wants. He doesn't need anything we have. If you look at Acts chapter 17, it'll tell you that. Next question. Is this how to act? Look at Matthew chapter 25:14-30. He says, again, it will be like a man going on a journey and called his servants and entrusted his wealth to them. And to one he gave 5 bags of gold, and to another 2 bags, and another 1 bag, each according to his ability. And some of your translations are going to say talent instead of a bag of gold. But the use of this translation for the word talent is not too far off, because a talent was worth about 6,000 denarii. And a denarii was a daily wage of a laborer, according to Matthew 20 and verse 2. So therefore, 1 talent would be equal to nearly 20 years worth of income, and 2 talents would be 40 years, and 5 talents would be equal to 100 years' wages. And the point here in using this particular translation is, no matter how you translate this, Even the one talent man had a lot of money in his possession. He went on the journey, and the man who received the five talents, what did he do? He gained five more. The two gained two more. The one, what did he do? He buried it in the ground. And just for your information, back then it was a rule of thumb that if you didn't want anybody to find something, you buried it. It's just one of the things that they did back then. Well, he tells him in verse 27, he says, well, then you should have put my money on deposit with the bankers so that when I returned, I would have received it back with interest. So take the bag of gold from him and give it to the one who has 10 bags, for whoever has will be given more, and they will have an abundance. And whoever does not have, even what they have will be taken from them, which is what he did with him. And throw this worthless servant outside into the darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Whatever we have needs to be used for the good of the master and also the institution for which he came to the earth to die for, which is the church. That's what we take away from this parable. Next question, what did the wisest man say about all this? Well, let's look at Ecclesiastes 5, verse 18 and 19. This is really interesting. Solomon said, this is what I have observed to be good, that it is appropriate for a person to eat, to drink, and to find satisfaction in their toilsome labor under the sun during the few days of life God has given them, for this is their lot. Moreover, when God gives someone wealth and possessions and the ability to enjoy them, to accept their lot and be happy in their toil, this is a gift of God. So the Bible's not telling us that we can't use any of it for us. This belays that thought. The lesson here, though, is to be happy with what you have, enjoy your lot in this life. Some people are so miserable worrying about who they are and what they are, they can't live. Ephesians 2 and verse 14 says, and I used to quote this to my kids all the time, do all things without grumbling and complaining. The next question is, what do we do with what we make? Ephesians 4 and verse 28 says, anyone who has been stealing must steal no more. In other words, stop the evil that you're doing and the sinning. But he must work doing something useful with their own hands that they may have something to share with those who are in need. The whole purpose in us being here and having what we have, our stuff, our money, or whatever, is to help others, people that are in need. And this actually shows the people around us that we have given God we love God enough to give him our heart and body and soul and mind. And okay, the next question, can we control what we have now after we die? Yes. They didn't have much control over it back then. Let me read Ecclesiastes 2, 18 and 19. This is what Solomon said. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. And of course, we know what his son did when he took over. He was evil. And who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish. Yet they will have control over all the fruit of my toil into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. Well, we live in a world today where we have laws. And so, you ever heard of a will and a trust fund? Most of you have. They're real simple. And there are legal ways to have control of your money and your possessions even after you die. And so there's no reason to fret over what's going to happen to your stuff and your money. It's real easy. and can be inexpensive and sometimes actually good for the church. If you got bad relatives and you don't want to give it to them, you can leave it to the church. And you can also leave it with stipulations and say if the church ever goes bad, it goes somewhere else. Or you can leave it to a university that's like Freed Hardeman. Next question. Do I have to give it all? Well, in Mark chapter 12, verse 41, Jesus sat down opposite the place where the offerings were put and watched the crowd putting their money into the temple treasury. And many rich people threw in large amounts, but a poor widow came and put in two very small copper coins worth only a few cents. And I actually have one in my Bible bag, and if you want to look at it, I'll show it to you after worship. Calling his disciples to him, Jesus said, "Truly I tell you, this poor widow has put more into the treasury than all the others. They all gave out of their wealth, and she out of her poverty put in everything, all she had to live on." And Hebrews 4 and verse 12 and 13 tells us that God knows the thoughts and intentions of our heart, and that we that almost should just scare us to death to do what's right. But I would rather y'all be motivated by the love of God and do what's right because you love him, because he first loved you. 1 John 4 and verse 18 says, love casteth out fear because fear involves punishment. Okay, next question. This is the next to the last one. I'm almost through. Where does my giving and stewardship start? Good question. Luke 12, 15 through 21. Then he said to them, "Watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in the abundance of possessions." And he told them this parable. The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. He thought to himself, "What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops." And he said, "This is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store my surplus grain. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry." But God said to him, "You fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. And then who will get what you have prepared for yourself?" This is how it will be with whoever stores up for things for themselves but is not rich toward God. It doesn't start with us. It starts with storing up riches toward God. It belongs to him anyway. Last question. Can I be lazy enough with my stuff to lose my soul? Proverbs 24:30. 3 and 34 says, "A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come on you like a thief, and scarcity like an armed man." I have seen people in this lifetime who, when they retired from the job that they had that fed them for many, many years, they retired from God too. This is not good. Revelation 2 and verse 10 says, "Be faithful unto death, and I'll give you a crown of life." And that actually literally means even if it results in your death. So we have to hang on all the way to the end and work for him. So what can we take away from all this? Everything we have in this world, which includes stuff, house, cars, trucks, money, yards, land, golf clubs, guns, clothes, tools, tractors, shovels, rakes, hoes, every talent and skill we have as a human belongs to God. And we're stewards of those things, which means we're going to give him an accounting of how we use those things and whether it was to his glory or ours. So I think if you're not doing this, you need to take some spiritual inventory of what, who you are, what you do, what you have, to make sure we're using it for the honor and glory and praise of God rather than ours. And if you have not obeyed the gospel, you need to do that before you do anything else, because that's the most important thing. If you're already a Christian and you've fallen away and you need the prayers of the church, you need to come make it right too. And let's do it while we stand and sing.